You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi marie, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa, no mai, haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. We've got no Soph today. She is away on holiday in Sydney, so I hope she is having a wonderful time. So yeah, you've just got me today. But e whai ake nei, coming up on the show today, I caught up with artist Luke Willis-Thompson about his current exhibition at Nutukaka Gallery B42040A1A1A. And Soph caught up with Yvonne Todd about her current exhibition at the Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead, Diary of a Carrot. He aha o whakara, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395-5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 5 9. And also after the show, you can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Oh, that's a good art.
Luke Willis-Thompson is a Fijian New Zealand artist currently based in Tāmaki. His politically geared practice circulates various mediums that are often conceptually driven, working amongst moving image, photography, performance, installation, and sculpture as modes of exploration. His current solo exhibition at Nutukaka Gallery B42040A1A1A presents two major moving image works, Whakamoemoea and Soro. Each work utilizes this visual language of political theater to imagine a decolonial future for Aotearoa. This exhibition includes the first presentation of Whakamoemoea in Aotearoa since its first viewing at the Sharjah Biennial. The work is set in 2040, centres a powerful address in Te Reo Māori on the Waitangi grounds by recognised broadcaster, journalist and politician Orini Kaipara. The second work shown within this exhibition, Soro, envisions a reenactment of the 2021 Dawn Raids apology, set 10 years on from the former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's apology, where an unnamed Prime Minister delivers the speech out of frame with the camera solely focused on recognised NZSL interpreter Alan Wendt. I caught up with Luke about the show and overall practice.
Kia ora katoa katoa, Nisa Bolivinaka. My name is Luke Willis-Thompson and I'm an artist and I live here in Tāmaki. My practice touches on a wide range of things, but I think it's safe to say I try to make work that is politically geared with a kind of philosophical bend to it. I've come to prominence for making films, and the show that I have on now is moving image, but I also make performances and photographs and sculpture and conceptual work too.
And your current solo exhibition showing at Nutukaka Gallery titled B42040A1A1A presents an installation of two major moving image works by you, Whakamoemoea and Soro. Both of these works position themselves in this place of looking forwards, with each work imagining a decolonial future for Aotearoa. I wanted to start this conversation surrounding these works by speaking to this idea of the imagined future. What influenced you into this mode of looking into the future as a method or like mode for approaching and accessing a work?
The kind of future orientation, I think it really came, I think, out of that sort of major disruption to the future that we experienced during COVID. The seeds to Whakamoemoea were born during lockdown in London and in 2020. And I was desperate to come back to Aotearoa. I couldn't. But at the same time, my experience of COVID wasn't bad. I lived in a block where we tried to organize to bring groceries for the older folks, and it was a mix of, you know, black and cockney and gentrifiers like myself, and we kind of came together because we couldn't let each other kind of deal with life alone, funerals and things like that. And there was something quite beautiful and socialistic about this project. And so I was kind of trapped in a present, you might say. And somewhere in along that time, I came across Matiki Mai Aotearoa, which is the report that Moana Jackson and his working group wrote after being commissioned by Margaret Mutu to consider, like, what a written constitution would be for Aotearoa and what it would mean to what could be a written constitution was the assignment. And what this working group did, of course, was to hold hui all over the country, I think 273 from memory, and I think another 78 ranga tahi hui, but those numbers could very well be wrong. And they were a mess, really, you know, over 300. And from this process, a document was made, and a readily available document. And that document thinks about a constitutional transformation. So not a new constitution, but a kind of great sort of, you know, I don't know, transformation, I think, not just politically, but in all spheres of life. It's a very beautiful emancipatory document. And Moana was asked somewhere along the line, you know, when do you think the first legislative steps should occur? And he said 2040, which is the, you know, obviously the 200th anniversary of the signing of Te Tiriti. I just sort of, that just got me thinking, like, what would it be if rather than just the first step, that was when we kind of accelerated, like, straight to this day of liberation, or straight to the to the revolution. And I just kind of, like, began to feel like that opened up, you know, avenues that we could approach these questions of things like Indigenous governance and Māori sovereignty from a slightly different angle if we, you know, envision them from the future. And the whole time, the writings of Dion Brand were sort of guiding me, and I really feel like these lines kind of sum up my what the films are trying to achieve to a certain degree. Brand writes, "Revolutions happen in the vein. They change you and you change yourself. You wake up in the morning changing. You say, this is the human being I want to be. You are making yourself for the future."
Beautiful. And I wanted to speak a bit about this choice of, because you are a multidisciplinary artist, the specific choice of choosing moving image as the mode for exploration for these works. What about that specific medium, kind of, what does it offer these ideas and allows you to do with the work?
I think, you know, the kind of, like, visuality of moving image, it serves so many different purposes, but in these works particular, what sort of, the sort of influences were, you know, things like Leon Narby and Elam graduates or recent graduates going to film the land marches, and things like citizen journalism and cell phone journalism, and things like, you know, public cable television in America, where a lot of native television shows were produced and kind of radical black content was aired to the masses. And I guess I just started to see that this thing that had been, you know, haunting our living rooms when we were children might still have a kind of strange anachronistic potential. So I wasn't thinking cinema, and I wasn't thinking, you know, like, durational experiential art film. I was thinking, like, what are the most democratic, lowbrow even sources to draw from where, you know, the message is prioritized and the beauty is a kind of byproduct.
Yeah. Endless exhibition includes the first presentation of Whakamoemoea in Aotearoa since its first viewing at the Sharjah Biennial. The work is set in 2040, centres around this powerful address in Te Reo Māori on the Waitangi grounds by recognised broadcaster, journalist and politician Orini Kaipara. Do you want to speak a bit about this work and, yeah, ideas held within it?
I think it's an introduction to Mā Tiki Mai. And I think it's safe to say it's a solid introduction. I think if you're really already up on Miss Kaupapa, then you might be looking at it for a different, you might be looking at it differently or looking for something different in it. But it's also kind of, I think, about educating the audience to some degree and really making sure that you can come in with no knowledge and you can be walked through an experience, a kind of experience of, like, hearing how it could be. And I suppose the hope is for my audience that they believe that's how it would be, that the fiction of the work does, you know, does its magic. To break that down, the work has a kind of arc. So the first half of the film, Orini really tells the story of, in very uncertain terms, what colonization did to Māori and the almost unlanguageable injustice of it. And there is, you know, a beautiful pau, and it brings questions of, I suppose, the right to talk about that pain, or why that sort of great pain is addressed. And then in the middle there is a kind of roll call, and it goes through the kinds of political heroes and leaders from the beginning right through the 20th century. And then the second half begins, and this veers in a totally different direction and thinks about restoration. It floats socialistic principles like the need or the desire that we live in a world where things are shared equally, that the benefits of living are shared equally. And it describes one model, and Mā Tiki Mai Aotearoa has many models that one could explore, but it explains the bicameral model, which is that you would have a kawangatanga sphere which could just operate as a liberal democracy, and that's how non-Māori would be governed, much the same as we are now. And then, or most people are now, the question of Pacific people is an open one, actually. And then on the other side, you would have the rangatiratanga sphere. And in that sphere, Māori would govern themselves through their iwi and hapu, and a fundamental principle would be that the kawangatanga sphere could not impose governance on the rangatiratanga sphere. So it is a platform where these two spheres have parliamentary sovereignty. They can't dictate. And what has to happen is a kind of working out through a kind of consensual democracy process. So it explores this notion of an indigenous future and political future. I think of a film as a political sci-fi film, political science fiction film.
Yeah, and the second work shown within this exhibition, Sorrow, envisions a reenactment of the 2021 Dawn Raids apology, set 10 years on from the former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's apology, where an unnamed Prime Minister delivers a speech out of frame. The camera instead focused on Recognise New Zealand SL interpreter Alan Wend. Would you like to speak a bit to this work and its contexts?
Yeah, the second film came about in a sort of roundabout way because I was the recipient of a commission called the New Dawn Funding Initiative, which actually came out of the earmarked money from Jacinda Ardern's Dawn Raid apology. So in effect, this film comes out of the kind of reparation that was offered to the Pacific community. And I went for that funding because my father lived through that period, was arrested multiple times in that period, and the Dawn Raids left a kind of mark, a kind of trauma on him. And it was something we knew about as children, but only with the scantest detail. And my father isn't alive, and many people from that time are not. And so there are still these kinds of open questions about it, right? Like I don't think every stone has been turned over. And so I was awarded this money to make a work, and I initially really kind of was choking on this commission.
Mm.
And that was partially because what I couldn't get over was the scale of the kind of economic, the kind of way that whole neighborhoods were dispossessed, right? Like, you know, if you think about Operation Pot Black, you're talking about mass arrests, and then these communities are so heavily gentrified.
Yeah.
And Grey Lynn, Ponsonby, etc. And I was just finding this question of what is that worth, right? Like, who benefits from that type of police brutality, right? Someone always benefits from police brutality. It's awful to say that, but, you know, we know very clearly that the property values of areas where black motorists are killed tend to go up, things like that. And so I was asking these kinds of questions through my initial research, and I was told off, you might say. And someone said, you know, Luke, we've already done the ifonga. The apology has been accepted. You know, it's time to focus on the healing. And I thought, but I'm not healed. I'm not fixed, you know.
Mm.
And so in a way, where this work merges from is this attempt to think the economics and then to kind of wrestle with that. And so basically, you know, Jacinda Ardern's Dawn Raid apology, for as important it was to the Pacific community, it's important, I do acknowledge that, I feel it too, but as a state apology, but its economic package, we're talking $2 million around about, or $2 or $3 million. The event itself probably cost, you know, almost as much as what was offered. And that is not enough money to repair Pacific life in this country.
Mm.
And we, New Zealand, still has an incredibly colonial relationship to the Pacific at large. It is as if New Zealand is content for the rest of the Pacific to be the wretched of the earth. And so what Soro does is it begins reenacting Jacinda's apology. The first, you know, two stanzas come directly from her apology. And then it kind of veers off, and it starts to think about what if we had an infinite amount of money, and if we re-engineered our political system towards Matiki Mai and towards Māori sovereignty, then what might the relationships be across the Pacific that were no longer bound on the kind of colonial schema or regime that is laid across it? And so it thinks these relationships, it thinks about recognizing the statehood of West Papua, it thinks about, you know, free travel or visa-less travel, it questions how our economy could actually improve through, you know, through a kind of United States of the Pacific or a kind of Pacifica Union.
And both of these works, works that you're speaking about and that are in this exhibition center around a public address, each offering an alternative method of address to one another. Whakamoemoea holding viewers in direct eye line with the speaker, while Soto offers a slight shift in address with the camera's sole focus on the interpreter, with audiences never hearing or seeing the actual speaker of the address. I wanted to ask about these decisions on centering versus decentering the speaker. How does the shift in forms of address translate to the ideas and experience of these works?
With Whakamoemoea, we took a long time to decide who Orini was playing, because I could see this image of her as this, you know, she is such an incredible speaker. I'm so proud of the work she is doing in the house today. When she graced our televisions, she was so precise and so direct. And so in a way, it felt right at a visual level or intuitive level before we knew actually who she was playing. And that was a source, you know, she was really on my case to figure out who she was playing. And it became clear, okay, you're playing yourself because of what you, who you were in the history of media, you know, because she's the first Wahine to wear a moko kawai or to have a moko kawai on to read the six o'clock news, which I think was already futuristic. You know, it was quite something for me to see that when I did back in 21 on Christmas Day. And she's been given this honour by the Rangatiratanga Congress for that moment. And so we wanted it, like me and my team of Tuneel, Aratini, Waratini and Jim Spears, we wanted it a bit kind of glitchy, a bit like a news, some cross between a news footage or a kind of state broadcast, but it's for a kind of mediated, it's for this hyper-mediated digital space. So you could imagine that clips of it would be cut and would kind of go viral and move, and so it didn't quite matter that its flow had a kind of visual staccato a look. And I think that added to its dreamlike nature. You know, like there's something about the way she almost jumps in the frame that she is sort of time traveling within the narrative arc of the story. And then Sora is kind of completely different because, of course, Alan Wentz was not just Jacinda Ardern's sign interpreter, but a favorite, you know, a kind of favored sign interpreter. He is incredible at his job. And he was present all through COVID as well. So there is that COVID connection. And who is giving this address is a kind of composite of a prime minister. You know, it breaks into me. I guess at some point it's a little bit me talking about my father. For at least the last three stanzas, it's just Moana Jackson's text. There is a lot of Dion Brand in there. I co-wrote the work with lawyer Dylan Asafo, and so it has both a kind of legalistic background language, and it also moves into the kind of poetic register that I like to write and think in. And you know, there is this other flip, right? Like Whakamoemoea is a dream, a dreaming process, or a collective dreaming, or a reason to dream, and Soro is an address in the Isoro in Fijian life is your personal accounting for your wrongdoing within a Fijian traditional justice system. And I think of the film, I think of Alan in this black and white 35mm kind of quite smoky, haunting light as sort of like that is taking place within a soul, you know. So there's a kind of like one film is taking place in a dream and one is kind of occurring within your interior. And I hope for Pacific audiences there is that feeling. You know, we wrestle with this and we wrestle with these questions and we wrestle whether anything productive can come from them.
And lastly, I wanted to ask, what is important about these works and their ideas for contemporary audiences now? What about the world today, especially here in Aotearoa, would benefit from experiencing these works?
I make these works because I believe they will happen, and I make them to happen. And Matiki Mai is the just and correct way for this country to go. And I think it is unfashionable to say, but I hope these works assist in the revolution.
That was Luke Willis-Thompson speaking to me about his current exhibition at Nutukaka Gallery, B42040A1A1A. The show is on until the 13th of March, so be sure to go and check that one out.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We've got a little song for you by Reb Fountain. This is Come Down, and be sure to come back for another interview. You're listening to Various Artists.
Just right.
services are venturing to our shores to entertain the masses with their magnificent chaos. Double whammy on June 2nd.
You'll be eating out of this Bristol duo's hands as they perform their gloriously unhinged blend of scrappy indie, post-punk and disco-fueled grooves.
Get Down Services, Double Whammy, June 2nd. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no, what if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
All right, you four Muppets, listen up. I finally pinpointed 95BFM's weak spot, Friday night, 7 till 9pm. The staff have all gone to watch Rick Breeze play water polo, so that's when we're going to strike. Phil, you're cracking the safe. Renee, you're disabling the alarm. Pat Fife, you load this BFM CD library into this sack. And Professor, you're driving the getaway van. Kushti. Ha ha ha, they're never going to see this coming.
Gang of Four, every Friday night from 7 till 9pm, with a revolving cast of bona fide BFM legends, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor are putting the B into TBIF. Gang of Four, thanks to Verona, the heart of Karangahape Road.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Yvonne Todd is a Tamaki-based multidisciplinary artist whose practice tends to obscure the familiar through a range of media to explore her subject matter, imperfection, absurdity, and the uncanny, all guiding her material language. Her current solo exhibition at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead, Diary of a Carrot, sees Todd further explore this long-standing interest in food as a subject, using a melange of sculpture, found and personal objects, AI-generated imagery and stage photography to make this absurdist narration on the act of eating. Best known within her work in stage photography, the show presents a shift in Todd's process, using AI to produce a new series, Selen 1818 Nibblers, which sees an assemblage of unenthusiastic Victorian women vacuously prodding at the plates of food they hold. Paired alongside personal archives, earlier work, and held within the historic home at Par Homestead, here food is not conceptually examined so much through the present as through it is through the past, allowing these notions of domesticity and nostalgia to thread and bind the works in space as viewers chew on the peculiar ways we engage with what and how we consume. Soph caught up with Yvonne about Diary of a Carrot and her wider practice.
Kia ora, my name's Yvonne Todd. I'm an artist and I'm primarily known for my photography work, but in recent years I've started experimenting with other types of art making, and my work in the Par Homestead is called Diary of a Carrot. It's a loosely a food-themed exhibition, but it does contain elements of sculpture and also some images made using AI, which is a direction I'm quite interested in kind of moving into.
Yeah, I want to get into talking a bit more about those different elements within your current exhibition at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead, Diary of a Carrot, which, as you say, sees you kind of further explore this long-standing interest in food as a subject visually, culturally and symbolically. I guess to begin speaking about the show or to introduce the show, are you able to speak to the origins of this interest in food as a subject in your practice and where your curiosity lies within the subject matter?
Sure. So when I was a child, my mum had a cookery book called Cookery in Colour, And I looked at it a lot because it was almost my first introduction into staged photography. And the way that the food was presented was of interest to me. The food in the book was really luridly saturated. It didn't look very appealing. And the kind of the food was fussy, odd food that, you know, there was a lot of things submerged in aspic and piped scrolls of mayonnaise. And it had a slight revulsion that I kind of noticed. But because it was sort of my, it was an introduction into like staged photography, setting something up to photograph. So for that reason, it sort of stayed with me as a memory. And then later on, when I studied photography, I really looked closely at still life photographers such as Irving Penn, who also brought this very precise approach to photographing food in a very different way. So I guess for me, it was always a subject matter that was part of some sort of formative experience with photography. As a child, I really liked studying food ads and magazines and the way, again, they were set up, how they were orchestrated. I found it really interesting. So I've sort of photographed food on and off for about, I don't know, 30 years or something. It's sort of not my primary subject matter, but it's like a satellite sort of subject. I find food amusing. I like the way it's about form and the recognisable. And also the food like represents something quite intimate. You put it in your mouth, you chew it and you swallow it. So why are certain foods like to some people not appealing or are appealing? I quite like the sort of sense of the vagaries of everyone's interest in food, or how it's quite a, you know, it's symbolic about also people coming together or eating alone. I don't know, there's all these sort of social sort of attributes as well to food that I'm intrigued by.
I like how your interest in food, it feels quite different to maybe how food has been taken an interest to in other contexts before. I think most people tend to look at food symbolically in quite a romantic way as kind of like a bringing together of people and the kind of beauty of that and the shared experience of that. But it's interesting to look at it in a more playful way, and I guess those kind of more odd experiences and takes on it, as you say, the kind of chewing and the intimacy of that, it's fresh.
Yeah, I think I was really interested in sort of the domestic sphere, and you know, there's things that relate to, you know, the frozen duopoly of peas and corn in the show, which to me are ciphers for my suburban existence. I'm really interested in drudge work, but sort of in hoarding, but sort of intersecting these ideas with elements of sort of perverse whimsy and artifice, and also survivalist doctrine within the domestic sphere. So, you know, the lockdown, the sort of lockdown era, the tasks, the sort of relentless sense of repetition, supermarket shopping. I think that all fed into it as well, sort of this non-romantic view of food as some sort of dreary necessity. That's sort of part of the show as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that it feels like that kind of binding domesticity in the works themselves, as this binding theme is really strong in the show. But yeah, your placement of the reference of food feels very within the home or within the family, with the inclusion of your home economics class writings, a lunch and snacks list, or in the sculptural works and objects, the fabric shampoo and the 1940s French kitchen cabinet. I guess even further to that, being in the historic space of Parr Homestead plays into this quite strongly too. It feels like you are in a house. Does your interest in food feel quite intertwined with these concepts of domesticity? And how do you kind of feel like the location of Parr Homestead guides these ideas within the works or recontextualizes them in that way?
Yeah, I think the fact that it was once a house, sort of quite an important part of the exhibition, because the Parr Homestead was built in 1879, and it was the reason why I developed this sort of suite of AI portraits called Sullen 1880s Nibblers, which is 18 images of these slightly unenthusiastic-looking Victorian woman who I sort of modelled on European royalty, Queen Victoria, quite dour with like recessive chins, and they're sort of distractedly poking and prodding at these little dainty plates of food. So the fact that they kind of came from the time when the house was built was totally intentional, and the sort of the ability to use the sort of grandiose marble like fireplace to perch, you know, a facsimile of sort of a tile of frozen corn on, and then sort of this arrangement of papier-mâché frozen peas arranged in there too, so quite sort of unpretentious materials being placed on these sort of permanent, grandiose sort of architectural features. So I really like, I know it seems obvious, but I do like sort of playing with the idea of opposites, you know, in terms of materials and things, you know, in this series particularly, or this exhibition. So the domestic space felt to me like a really good starting point.
You mentioned earlier, of course, the show brings together a range of media within your practice, including sculpture, stage photography, AI-generated images and objects. Are you able to speak a little bit more to this materiality within the show and what interests you in exploring the subject matter across these different media rather than just one?
Yeah, well, I think it sort of stems back to 2024 when I did my master's in fine arts, and my rationale for doing it was to maybe try something that wasn't photographic. So I really wanted to spend the year trying things that were out of my sort of quite formulaic way of working, without the sense, well, a sense of accountability, but also not being too concerned about creating products. Generally, the way I work, I sort of manufacture a framed photograph that is sold in a, you know, a dealer gallery. And I really wanted just to kind of noodle around with materials. And the process was so enjoyable and to me that I just wanted to kind of keep going. But I've used some of the works that I made for my master's in 2024 in the show, like the tree branch, which is sort of sheathed in a sleeve, and it's dangling at the snacks cracker, and the papier-mâché peas. And then there's sort of these elements of kind of hippie psychedelia, like there's a sort of a crystal, like, you know, those sun catchers you dangle in a window, there's one of those, but it's got like little fake peas, green peas on its thread. Kind of foolish stuff that to me was like really amusing to make, and didn't have the sense of labour that I often feel as a photographer. Just the activities felt far more, I don't know, relatable, low stakes, not necessarily easy, but the sense of pressure to create was quite different. So it sort of just kept going. And then, you know, the kind of food idea just sort of emerged from this process.
I want to hear a little more about the series you mentioned before, Sullen 1880s Nibblers, which, as you said, sees an assemblage of unenthusiastic AI-generated pictures of Victorian women vacuously prodding at the plates of food that they hold. You spoke a bit about the series earlier, but stage photography has been a huge part of your practice. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what informed the shift to using AI in this series. Are you able to speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, sure. So my experimentations with AI came about at the end of doing my MFA. I had to produce sort of a consignment, and I'd seen AI online on Instagram, etc., and thought a lot of it was really quite underwhelming, unsurprising, doc image library kind of stuff. And I was quite dismissive of AI, but I decided I'd just try it out to make some images for this document I'd made. And just in doing so, I sort of found that it was such this like medium, it was such a plastic kind of way of creating images in my mind's eye without the expense, that it was almost like writing a script, a movie script for a still image. So I could write very detailed prompts and get these really specific images. But the really important thing was the AI images I was making still looked like they were my photos. So I felt that it wasn't a huge sense of disconnect between the images I was known for making and the AI versions. So it was sort of, to me, just felt like an extension of being a photographer. And then I just started getting, because I can, you know, I guess I can fixate on a AI project for maybe, I don't know, 10 hours at a time. And it's like finding the grit and getting the grit in the oyster and then seeing what odd, surprising things will happen. So I've sort of now developed a kind of pattern of working with AI. And I know AI is fraught with issues, from, you know, ethical issues to the amount of power used. So I know it's, you know, seen as quite a problematic medium in a lot of ways. But for me, it became quite an addictive, you know, I felt like it was the medium I'd been waiting my career as an artist to arrive. I've kind of embraced it, and I'm not sure if I would return to traditional photography. I don't know. Each shoot I did as a photographer became more and more difficult in my mind. The AI feels feels like a lot more, I don't know, just like free, a lot easier in some ways to use. But I'm still sort of applying my high standards to it, but it's capable of surprising me. So anyway, back to the nibblers. So the thing with AI is I can create variations on an idea, sort of endless variations. So it's like being a photographer and just having, you know, a large number of proof sheets to choose from. Whereas before, I was shooting generally on large format film cameras, and I'd take 10 photos and with the expectation I'd have one usable image from the shoot. Whereas now I feel like there's just a sort of abundance of possible usable works. So I can now work sort of in multiples and in much larger numbers to sort of hammer home the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, it's not what I intended as an artist, but it feels like the right thing in terms of what I've been developing.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that kind of shift. I think also you're able to use AI, but also bring in so much of your own experience from your photography and your knowledge of stage photography. And so, yeah, it's awesome to see how that kind of translates in the way that you experiment with AI.
You know, I think AI, if you have knowledge of making images, I think it really helps, because you can maybe bypass some of the sort of cliches or the more obvious ways of using it. It's sort of having specialist knowledge that can be applied.
Yeah, I think the series too also really grounds this binding idea of time, which I think is captured in the show, where food is not examined conceptually through the present, but rather through much earlier periods of time, such as the Victorian era. But then you've got that interplay between looking at a time so far back, but using a really present form of technology. What kind of informs your attraction to explore these ideas of food and domesticity through this lens of time?
Well, I think the idea of having the Victorian characters, it was more about giving them something to do, and that's why they've got food. Otherwise, the photos wouldn't really connect with the show. But I think AI works really well when you can bring different things together. So, you know, often I think successfully there's sort of mashups of types of genres of music. So you'll have a heavy metal song as a yacht rock song, or, you know, I like the way AI can combine the familiar to make something new. And that's to me the sort of what I find compelling about it. So the food was sort of a way of, you know, just having AI, being able to use it in the show. I did sort of experiment with creating like AI cookbook images. But they didn't quite do it for me, but they were intriguing. Like there were some really bizarre combinations of food, and they looked like quite slick, highly produced images. But I didn't know if they were interesting enough, but it was like I enjoyed making them. And then the idea was to get AI to design some sculptures of food, which I would make, which it did quite an interesting job of again, but it didn't quite translate. So I do, you know, I do really love the photographic portraits, and it just felt that should be part of it, like there should be that sort of human presence in there, even though these women, to me, they're like the same person, it's just different iterations of one character, which I also like that idea, the sort of taking the sort of qualities of a person and just making multiple versions of this one person. So it sort of just fed into my interest, you know, in using portraiture, but giving, like, having a food sort of element.
Yeah, I think what's been quite a common thread throughout talking to you today is, I guess, these ideas of that, or these kind of qualities of general peculiarities and oddities that you lean into your practice, and particularly for this show, where you're playing quite strongly with these ideas of absurdity through the lens of food. What kind of interests you about, and generally about, skewing the familiar in this sense, and how do you think that alters the way in which viewers might engage with the show?
I've always been interested in ideas around the familiar and making the familiar seem strange, sort of. Even, like, I suppose, taking quite sort of commercial or mainstream looking images and applying that treatment to my own sort of ideas. So I think for the, you know, I've enjoyed hearing from people who have found the show, like, amusing, weird or funny, because that's kind of what my intention was, that it was going to be a sort of slightly frivolous, ridiculous, but also in some ways slightly disturbing in places, investigation, but also taking an idea that's so broad, it's impossible to kind of speak to every aspect of the idea. So it's like a little slice, you know, of my take on something. Also, I don't know, I have a weird relationship with food myself. Like, I eat the same thing every day. I have quite rigid, strange approach in my personal life to food. And I kind of sort of wanted to think about that as well, and also, like, the inclusion of my Takapuna Normal Intermediate Home Economics Exercise book. I feel like there's a shared New Zealand experience of the intermediate school home economics, or now food technology or hospitality classroom, with the communal cooking on the, you know, electric ovens, the kind of food that's made. I don't know, I feel like it's a real, there's a real New Zealand flavour to this experience. And my exercise book, there was a lot of references to, like, eggs and cheese. That seemed to be the, that seemed to be what was being really being pushed. And I remember at the time eggs were seen as problematic for people with high cholesterol, and there was a real push to, like, put eggs forward as something really healthy, that you, it was okay to eat one egg a day, it was fine, it sort of had some sort of high level health clearance. So I just remember eggs were really pushed on us because of there was, like, this, you know, some sort of egg industry drive to get people eating them. So just the sort of, you know, the ever-changing landscape of health and where we look to for our health information. And, you know, obviously as intermediate school students, it was from the home economics teacher, was had the info, had all the, you know, the knowledge that we followed. It's just the sort of the wayward strands of experience, of my personal experience in there as well.
Yeah, so interesting. You're playing with, I guess, the personal, but also the deeply impersonal.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Yeah, and, like, the whole preponderance of information from the wellness industry, it feels overwhelming. It's starting to scrutinise everything you consume. It feels like it's not really sustainable. To kind of live under these conditions. So I quite like the sort of, like, really, like, focusing on the food that was familiar to me as a child, which was, you know, dairy, peas, corn, quite, from today's standards, quite basic and unsophisticated food.
Back to basics.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, we all have our preferences, and I feel like it's okay to have them, have your own weird things. When I was pregnant with my first child, I kept obsessing over, like, childhood nostalgia foods. I didn't want to eat them, but I thought about them a lot. Like,
interesting.
Battered hot dogs, things I hadn't eaten for a long time, you know, types of biscuits, and eating creamed rice at kindergarten, like, all these weird memories that I'd forgotten about came back. And it was, there was something oddly comforting just thinking about these things that I probably wouldn't want to eat now, but was seen as, like, staples. And I think that's sort of, I don't know, there's some sort of suppressed memories of that in the show as well.
That was artist Yvonne Todd speaking to Soph about her current exhibition on at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead, Diary of a Carrot. The show is on until the 22nd of March, so be sure to go check that one out too.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
We'll be right back with your arts guide, but in the meantime, this is Blend by Aldous Harding.
Hey man, I really need you back again. The years are plenty. Somewhere I have a watercolor you did. I saw you walking on the sand in Thailand.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Luke Willis Thompson's B42040A1A1A is on at Nutukaka Gallery until the 13th of March. As also mentioned on the show, Yvonne Todd's Diary of a Carrot is on at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead until the 22nd of March. Dreaming from Afar, a group show exhibiting work by Brunel Diaz Prims, Gian Manick and Tyrone Tewa is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 2nd of May. Julian Dashbir's Midwestern Unlike You and Me is on at Michaelette until the 7th of March. Fiona Connor's Blanket Games is on at Coastal Signs until the 14th of March. Justin Tenney's Engine is on at Treadler until the 13th of March. Gordon Bennett and Emily Kadakar, Under the Undercurrents, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 11th of April. Grace Terry's solo exhibition, To Look Twice, is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 6th of March. Marama Taka, a group show of artworks by 12 Māori artists, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 7th of March. And yeah, if you have something you want on the Arts Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa e korero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us, Luke Willis Thompson and Yvonne Todd. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in and remember you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our our Instagram at 95BFM Various Artists for more. Up next, we've got The Land of the Good Groove with Murray. My name is Maya, and that was Various Artists. We'll catch you next week. You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.